This is Betty Joram, February 2012. The Ouroboros, Nature and Human Nature. This was recorded on DVD, and there were a few images on the DVD. It's available in the library at the Jung Society.
Well, good evening, everyone. We're very, very happy to see you come. And we're very privileged tonight to have Betty Joram as a speaker. Now, Betty Joram has been a member of our group for many years. As a matter of fact, she's a past president of the Seattle Jung Society. She got her PhD at Pacifica, and her dissertation was on alchemy. And a few of us have been very privileged to have had some further classwork with Betty on her dissertation, which has been wonderful. So the topic tonight, the Ouroboros, of course, is something dear to her heart, and we're very happy to have her come. Thanks.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming tonight. So today we come together to investigate the alchemical image of the Ouroboros, the serpent that devours its own tail, a symbol of the union of opposites. For some time now, I've been working with the processes of transformation and change using various series of alchemical images as an internal map and orienting compass. The Rosarium Philosophorum, which Jung interpreted in the Psychology of the Transference, profoundly influenced me, as well as the Splendor Solis and the Vessels of Hermes, which became the armature of my dissertation. There is a psychoactive field generated by the underlying symbolic references that flow from the alchemical images. Preparing for this lecture was no exception. So I will begin with a moment of synchronicity while I was holding this tension of the opposites and contemplating the image of the Ouroboros that occurred on a Saturday morning several weeks ago, following 5 days of seclusion during the snow. I walked up the hill to the business district on California Avenue to have breakfast and a latte and a walk through the neighborhood. The French bakery, though small, is very popular and was filled with customers. I sat at a table when it opened up and then invited a couple with a new baby to join me, a 9-week-old infant asleep in the pouch on the father's chest. In the course of our conversation about the baby and the experience of these new parents, they shared the following. The woman's father had died quite unexpectedly when the baby was just 2 weeks old. She and the baby had just returned from extended time with her family. She spoke of how the new baby brought joy to everyone there, but it was clear that she was in mourning for her father. Birth and death, joy and sorrow, beginnings and endings, the Ouroboros. When they asked how I would spend the rest of the day, I told them that I was preparing a talk about consciously holding the opposites to honor them, each in their own way and in turn, and both together. I gave them my condolences and my congratulations as I prepared to leave. I, too, am a work in progress on this great task. As I was finishing my dissertation and graduating with my PhD, my husband was dying from cancer. During our 29 years together, he built our house and then became a sculptor. His work exists everywhere in my life. In the months that follow his death, I have found myself trying to reconcile presence and absence, beginnings and endings, life and death, the great round. Tonight, we will cover the mythological underpinnings of the Ouroboros. The Ouroboros as an archetype, the archetype as experience, the alchemical symbolism of the Ouroboros, the fourfold structure, the astrological signs and houses, the intersection of self and world. During the workshop tomorrow, we will be spending time reflecting on and engaging with the opposites in Ouroboric reverie. So those of you that wish to come back, we're going to try to hold those opposites together and contemplate them and see what emerges from that experience. The image of the Ouroboros depicts a serpent or winged dragon eating its own tail. An ancient symbol of beginnings and endings, the word is derived from the Greek oura, meaning tail, and boros, eating. The Ouroboros devours and gives birth to itself ever and again as it circles round the center. Eric Neumann, in The Origins and History of Consciousness, begins his discussion with the image of the Ouroboros as the first mythological stage in the evolution of consciousness. He is speaking simultaneously about the not yet formed ego, which is contained in the unconscious, and the dawning of the human attempt to imagine how the earth itself, the oceanic depths and the heavens above, plants, animals, and humans came to be here in the first place. In the time, the Ouroboros is an attempt to describe what it was like in the beginning, in the time of formlessness and chaos. Here is an excerpt from the Babylonian creation myth, Enuma Elish, written around 2000 BCE. The first tablet, when in the height heaven was not named, and the earth beneath did not yet bear a name, and the primeval Apsu who begat them, and chaos, Tiamat, the mother of them both, their waters were mingled together, and no field was formed, no marsh was to be seen, when of the gods none had been called into being, and none bore a name, and no destinies were ordained, then were created the gods in the midst of heaven. Note that Tiamat, the roiling salt sea, birthed both herself and Apsu, who therefore was both her son and husband. Tiamat appeared in the form of a monstrous, bloated sea serpent. She was the keeper of the tablets of destiny. Apsu was a god of fresh water who emerged from below the sea. From their mating, Tiamat gave birth to the elder deities, Lamu and Lahamu, the muddy, who were the parents of the axis of heaven and earth, named Anshar and Kishar, grandparents of Anu and Enki, or Ea. You may remember Enki from the myth of Inanna. He is the older god to whom Inanna's servant appealed for help when the queen of heaven did not return from the underworld. After a time, Tiamat and Apsu, the primal parents, plotted to kill their offspring. The plot was discovered by Ea, who destroyed Apsu. Kingu, Tiamat's son, consort, another example of the sun-lover myth, brought her news of the murder of Apsu. To avenge her husband's death, in the second tablet it is written, Umu Huber, Tiamat, who formed all things, made in addition weapons invincible. She spawned monster serpents, sharp of tooth and merciless of fang. With poison instead of blood she filled their bodies. Fierce monster vipers she clothed with terror. With splendor she decked them. She made them of lofty stature. Whoever beheld them, terror overcame him. Their bodies reared up, and none could withstand their attack. She set up vipers and dragons, and the monster Lahamu, and hurricanes, and raging hounds, and scorpion men, and mighty tempests, and fishmen, and rams. Doesn't Tiamat's army of monsters, storm demons, sea serpents, fishmen, scorpion men, remind us of our own superheroes and villains, as well as the devastating hurricanes, earthquakes, fires, floods, and tsunamis born of this planet? Eventually, a hero god, Marduk, from the freshwater sea, defeated Tiamat. Half of her dismembered body became the heavens, the other half the earth. Her tail became the Milky Way, and her eyes the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Marduk also conquered Kingu, to whom Tiamat had given the tablets of destiny. Taking the tablets for himself, Marduk now reigned supreme. He created stations in the heavens for the old gods and fixed the stars of the zodiac. Here is the battle scene between Marduk and Tiamat from the fifth tablet. Marduk begins by calling Tiamat, the sea serpent, out of the depths. And against the gods my fathers thou hast contrived thy wicked plan. Let then thy host be equipped, let thy weapons be girded on. Stand, I and thou, let us join battle. When Tiamat heard these words, she was like one possessed. She lost her reason. Tiamat uttered wild, piercing cries. She trembled and shook to her very foundations. She recited an incantation. She pronounced her spell. And the gods of battle cried out for their weapons. Then advanced Tiamat and Marduk, counselor of the gods. To the fight they came on, to the battle they drew nigh. The Lord spread out his net and caught her, and the evil wind that was behind him he let loose in her face. As Tiamat opened her mouth to its full extent, he drove in the evil wind, while as yet she had not shut her lips. The terrible winds filled her belly, and her courage was taken from her, and her mouth she opened wide. He seized the spear and burst her belly. He severed her inward parts. He pierced her heart. He overcame her and cut off her life. He cast down her body and stood upon it. Listen to these words and the images they evoke. They are relevant to our discussion of the intersection between self and world. I sat bolt upright Monday night when I heard a description of a photograph connected to the investigation of Susan Powell's disappearance and the murder-suicide of her sons and husband. The photo allegedly showed the torso of a woman run through with a sword, the length of her body, exiting from her heart. Listen again to what Mark Duke did to Tiamat. He seized the spear and burst her belly. He severed her inward parts. He pierced her heart. He overcame her and cut off her life. He cast down her body and stood upon it. Jung sternly warns of the power of possession by the raw forces in the unconscious. When the ego becomes inflated and identified with Marduk or any other archetype, terrible things can happen. According to Neumann, the mythological projection of psychic material appears in cosmogonic form as the mythology of creation. The world and the unconscious predominate and form the objects of myth. Ego and man are only nascent as yet, and their birth, suffering, and emancipation constitute the phases of the creation myth. Neumann then revisits these creation myths from the perspective of the personal struggle for individual consciousness with its heroic reenactments. The ego's emergence from the primordial mother, the slaying of the monster mother, and the slaying of the monster father, while incorporating or devouring vital aspects of the parents, is essential for growth and development. As I was reflecting on Tiamat and Apsu, and the Egyptian image of Shu, the air god separating Nut from heaven, and Geb, earth, I thought about the age of the child when parents frequently get divorced. Often this occurs at the stage of development when the child's ego is emerging from the unconscious. There's an unconscious archetypal struggle to separate the parents as the child's ego is forming. Simultaneously, the parents need to absorb their own childhoods and their self-centeredness in order to mature into adulthood. Jung tells us that the use of these images, the alchemical images and art in general, but the archetypal images that emerge spontaneously from the unconscious, the use of these images requires at any rate an alert and lively fantasy, and this is not an attribute of those who are inclined by temperament to purely intellectual concepts. These offer us something finished and complete, whereas an archetypal image has nothing but its naked fullness, which seems inapprehensible by the intellect. Concepts are coined and negotiable values. Images are life. And that's from volume 14 from the Mysterium Conjunctionis. Images are life. According to Jung, the defining characteristics of an archetype are universality, numinosity, unconsciousness, and autonomy. The Ouroboros has appeared worldwide throughout history in ancient Egypt, Greece, India, and beyond as a symbol of creation. In Mexico, Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, can be seen biting its tail. The spontaneous appearance and universal nature of such a symbol indicates an endeavor by the unconscious to express a truth which language can only attempt to convey through paradox. I'll say that one again. The spontaneous appearance and universal nature of such a symbol indicates an endeavor by the unconscious to express a truth which language can only attempt to convey through paradox. Of the ancient Egyptian Ouroboros, it was said, it slays, weds, and impregnates itself. It is man and woman, begetting and conceiving, devouring and giving birth, active and passive, above and below at once. So here we have the soul being returned to the hermaphroditic corpse in the tomb. We have the serpents devouring themselves. There's the soul departing from the person who has suffered the fatal wound. But here's the resurrected corpse being fed the soul back into the body again. So there's some truth in that experience that the image is trying to give us, and we don't have language adequate to the task. The opposites within the archetype. In the opening paragraph of the Mysterium Conjunctionis, Jung states, the factors which come together in the conjunctio are conceived as opposites, either confronting one another in enmity or attracting one another in love. To begin with, they form a dualism. For instance, the opposites are moist, dry, cold, warm, upper, lower, heaven, earth, fire, water, bright, dark, active, passive, gaseous, solid, precious, cheap, good, evil, open, hidden, east, west, living, dead, masculine, feminine, soul, and luna. Often the polarity is arranged as a quaternio, or quaternity, with the two opposites crossing one another, as for instance the four elements or the four qualities, moist, dry, cold, and warm, or the four directions and seasons, thus producing the cross as an emblem of the four elements and symbol of the sublunary physical world. The key concepts here are the initial animosity between the opposites and their propensity toward union. We will revisit the quaternio aspect of the opposites shortly. According to Edinger, the opposites constitute the most basic anatomy of the psyche. The flow of libido, or psychic energy, is generated by the polarization of opposites in the same way as electricity flows between the positive and negative poles of an electrical circuit. Spirit and matter, symbolized by winged and wingless birds or dragons, is an important pair of opposites for us to consider. Marion Woodman has written and taught brilliantly on this subject. Her works on eating disorders and addictions, for example, Addiction to Perfection, or The Pregnant Virgin, address the devastating consequences of this split and their transformation. Her workshops are alchemical retorts in which spirit is reunited with matter. She has tremendous compassion for the suffering of the feminine and matter, and an extraordinary ability to understand and convey its message to the world. But for the moment, let us consider good and evil. Good and evil form a crucial and terrifying pair of opposites, which can threaten the survival of the ego. A great deal of energy goes into defending the ego from the consciousness of its own evil. If the weight of evil outweighs the good, one can become totally demoralized. This apparently is what happened to Josh Powell when he decided to end his own life and his son's. The evidence was just stacked against him. Good and evil, spirit and matter, conscious and unconscious, masculine and feminine, ego and shadow, sun and moon. When the opposites are polarized, the ego swings back and forth between them like a pendulum, oscillating between guilty inferiority and optimism. I have seen this manifest as anxiety disorders and panic attacks. According to Melanie Klein, anxiety is generated by the splitting and projection of good and bad part objects in order to keep them pure and separate. She termed this the paranoid schizoid position. I'm good, I'm bad, I'm great, I'm terrible, I'm all, I'm nothing. You get this, you know, anxiety that just goes like one of those little executive desk toys, you know, with the balls on the little chain, and you click one and it pops this way and swings back and pops the other. That's the way anxiety works. Good, bad, back and forth. So according to Melanie Klein, anxiety is generated by the splitting and projection of good and bad part objects in order to keep them pure and separate. Now, how many of you know object relations theory? And we can have a discussion about it later, but that's... Melanie Klein was a student of Freud's and wrote a lot about this in London in the 1930s and 40s. And so part of trying to integrate this material to be therapeutically useful, you know, start bringing stuff in from all over, okay? But it's interesting to see where other theories come together with what Freud is understanding from this alchemical process of the Ouroboros. Okay, we try to see how this comes up in other forms. So this split between good and bad, Melanie Klein called the paranoid schizoid position. Jung explains the magnitude of the crisis brought about by the polarization of the opposites. He says, the one after another is a bearable prelude to the deeper knowledge of the side by side, for this is an incomparably more difficult problem. Again, the view that good and evil are spiritual forces outside us, and that man is caught in the conflict between them, is more by far than the insight that the opposites are the ineradicable and indispensable preconditions of all psychic life, so much so that life itself is guilt. Okay. All right. Life itself is guilt. Yes. And that's the defensive position, right? I'm in my own little shell. I have nothing to do with anybody. Everything I need, I can make for myself. It's the kind of creation myth of omnipotence, right? And anything I do, Marduk, you know, dismembering Tiamat, the conflict of all the gods, anything I do is okay because I am all-powerful and all of this stuff comes from me or is me or none of it is me, right? That's a very self-centered, uroboric, narcissistic position. Yeah. Right. And so that's part of the struggle of the emerging of consciousness out of the unconscious. Because kids are unconscious yet. I mean, they may appear like they know what they're doing, but there's a lot of ego formation that's going on. And in that state of unconsciousness, they create and destroy the world all the time. A lot of what little kids like to do is build things up and tear them down, right? Make stacks of stuff and then spread them all over and do that, tear things apart. And you know. So, yes, that childhood state is part of what Neumann's talking about the emergence of consciousness from the unconscious parallels these great big creation myths. In the beginning, there was nothing. And then everything came into being out of this formlessness. Notice how deftly Jung moves the spiritual question of good and evil from an externalized condition. That's good, that's evil. To an understanding of the opposites as an ineradicable and indispensable precondition of all psychic life. This good and bad. Right? I love my mom and I hate my mom. I love my dad and I hate my dad. I love myself and I hate myself. Those things, right? That we are all part of that. We need to kill in order to eat. You know, that whole thing that we can distance ourselves and have everything wrapped in plastic, but it doesn't change our guilt over killing, over murdering other species, right, in order to stay alive, right? It doesn't change the fact that at the bottom we'd have to hunt if we were starving. We would kill for it. So it's just that we pass our guilt off onto others, right? It's the corporations that are evil, not I who need to buy the product that they sell. Right. So this understanding of the opposites as an ineradicable and indispensable precondition of all psychic life, we could spend some time in the position of the tail eater chewing on that idea, and we may do that tomorrow. Just hang out there for a while. Von Franz describes the archetype of the Ouroboros as a condition where the opposites are one. The head is at one end and the tail at the other. They are one but have an opposite aspect, and when the head and the tail, the opposites, meet, there a flow is born, which is what the alchemists mean by the mystical or divine water, described as the meaningful flux of life. With the help of the instinct of truth, life goes on as a meaningful flow, as a manifestation of the self. That is the result of the conjunctio in this case. In many other cases, it is described as the philosopher's stone, but as many texts say, the water of life and the stone are one. Well, that's the union of opposites, right? It's the union of opposites. Is that God taking the hand of man? Is that the ego taking the hand of the self? Is that the masculine taking the hand of the feminine? That's the question, right? These are the images that are trying to describe this union. And as an archetype, it has this great power. And when this would appear, when the alchemists were drawing this, they would have had some aha about what was going on in the flask. Something would have changed. And there would have been an aha. Jung viewed the archetype as a psychosomatic concept, linking body and psyche, instinct and image. The archetypes, or their images, become outwardly visible in patterns of instinctual behavior and cluster around basic and universal experiences of life. We can see the archetypal sources in our ideas and images of mother and mothering, father and fathering, birth, death, marriage, and so on. Jung referred to archetypal experiences such as fording a river or going through an initiation. He also encountered the archetypes as symbols such as moon or tree. Because these events and forms have been historically experienced and perceived, they accrued layers of meaning which became part of their rich history. Their universality, unconscious origins, autonomy, and numinosity allow the archetypes to erupt into consciousness and to be experienced with transformative energy. One can also be overwhelmed by the emergence of unconscious contents, which seemingly come out of nowhere or as a response to inner tensions or struggles with the outer environment. Creation myths can help us understand the processes involved in wresting a new consciousness from the prima materia of the unconscious. The archetype of the Ouroboros gives us an image which helps us to assimilate the components in conflict, to take them back into ourselves and generate a new way of responding to the world. This image?
Yes.
Okay. So it looks to me like the alchemist on the left has got some sort of a wash tub, something like that. He's doing some activity that relates to grinding up things or rinsing things or something probably that has to go into the flask. But the flask is the dominant image here. And what Jung talked about was, with alchemy, the psychological contents would get projected into the flask, and the flask would contain them. And they could be worked on independently of what you have to do in your outside life. So if you got to do your housework, but you're really in conflict over whether or not to go back and see your parents for Christmas, you know, and those kinds of things are going to war in you. And that's just an example that I see pretty often in my practice. If you can contain that conflict and still go about your daily routine with some degree of equanimity, the conflict can go on in there because maybe there's something that's getting, that needs to be understood about your relationship between yourself and your parents, and reacting like you did when you were 10 no longer serves. I can remember a professor of mine in my master's program at the U in the 1970s saying, "How come every time I go home to see my parents, I regress?" And the man was 50. Okay, so there is a complex in there. And if you can put the complex in the flask, the birds, the cormorant and the crow, they're black to represent the spiritual negredo. We're going to talk about this more later, but the alchemical process of things rotting away and decaying takes on this black form. But also when matter itself begins to become conscious, when you start to understand what it is that you do, let's say, that makes your stomach clenched in relationship to your mother, when all she said was, "Would you please set the table?" You know, but you start to become conscious of what this body issue is that's going on. What is it that makes you nervous? And the psyche starts to activate. Then the instincts are beginning to tell you something about, I don't know what. Do you let yourself get bullied? Do you react sharply when she didn't mean to hurt your feelings? Why are you, you know, is she overly sensitive? Are you overly sensitive? You start to cook this stuff, and you just hold on to it. I love my mother. I can't stand my mother. I love my mother. I can't stand my mother. You know, you do that for a while, but you don't take it out on anybody else. You leave it contained, but you observe it. You let it work, and you let it cook outside of you. And so that's, you know, part of what therapy does. It lets you cook these issues, you know, but you take it to the therapy office rather than taking it home to your kids or your spouse or your parents or whatever that is. You cook it in a vessel that's outside of your daily life so that you can function in a more, just an easier way. You're not always stressed, for instance, by what's going on around you. In the Mysterium Conjunctionis, Jung is talking about unconscious imagery that has to do with incest and this comes up in the alchemical manuscripts because the symbols of the sun and the moon are the brother and sister of Apollo and Diana, and he talks about these things. And he said they would have this narrative going in the alchemical literature that you take the royal couple out to this oven or a curcubit, and the hieros gamos, the union of this brother-sister pair, happens in this oven. And Jung says, he starts to talk about extra psychic space that doesn't necessarily happen in your person. You don't concretize this. You don't literalize this action. You cook it outside of yourself. And he says there must be some benefit to being able to do that. And so this projection, what gets projected into the flask, while they're just mixing up horse dung and lead scraps and whatever it is that they throw in there, and they're watching it all cook and seeing this stuff go on, some kind of psychological process is happening. Does that answer your question? Okay, we're going to move further into alchemy. That was the prelude. The alchemical symbols of the Ouroboros. Deeper than sleep, but not so deep as death, I lay there sleeping, and my magic head remembered and forgot. On first cry, I remembered and forgot and did believe. I knew love, and I knew evil. woke to the burning song and the tree burning blind, despair of our days, and the calm milk giver who knows sleep, knows growth, the sex of fire and grass, and the black snake with gold bones. Black sleeps, gold burns. On second cry, I woke fully and gave feed and fed on feeding. Gold seed, green pain, my wizards in the earth walk through the house, black in the morning dark. Shadows grew in my veins, my bright belief, my head of dreams, deeper than night and sleep. Voices of all black animals crying to drink. Cries of all birth arise, simple as we, found in the leaves, in clouds and dark, in dream, deep as this hour, ready again to sleep. Jung recognized the patterns of creation. That poem was from Muriel Rukeyser, and she wrote it in in the 1940s, I believe. So, Jung recognized the patterns of creation myths, fragments of religious symbols, liturgical rituals, and apocalyptic visions in the images and narrative descriptions of the alchemists. He spent years studying these manuscripts. He realized that the alchemists had projected their psychological contents and conflicts onto matter, and attempted to contain them in the flasks. The alchemists considered spirit and matter to be indispensable to one another. This placed them in a heretical and necessarily secretive relationship to the Catholic Church, which idealized spirit and demonized matter and the body. The alchemists thought of Mercurius, that duplex, triune, and fourfold trickster, as the animating spirit in matter, which the Church equated with the devil, the source of evil and sin. Alchemy was based on actual techniques of metallurgy, in which mercury figures prominently in the extraction of metals from ores, particularly gold. Over time, Mercurius came to stand for all aspects of the opus, from the raw materials or prima materia to the process of transformation to the goal or lapis itself. The work consisted of separating and dissolving the components, followed by putrefaction, circular distillation, and extraction of the essence, the multiplicatio, and the creation of the elixir, or the lapis philosophorum. So the Latin solvimus, we dissolve, putrefacimus, we putrefy, sublimimus, we sublimate, dividimus, we divide. Componimus, we put back together. And Jung thought that that really suited the description of analysis. That when you're doing this stuff, you take it apart. Sometimes you feel pretty rotten. You do get it all volatile a little bit and worked up. You divide it up again, and then you put it all back together. In the opening pages of the opus, the substances that were mixed together were observed to be hostile to one another. When the metals were dissolved and heated, the liquids roiled and the vapors rose, creating the appearance of the initial chaos that gave rise to Tiamat. The alchemists saw images of combat, of forms created and swallowed back into the primal sea. The vapors were seen as spirits ascending, the salts as corpses at the bottom of the flask. The fact that the glass now held outside of the person what had formerly been an internal state of suffering proved to be a critical component in making unconscious conflicts conscious, therefore subject to transformation and resolution. This is what the alchemists called the aurum spiritualis, the spiritual gold, not to be confused with the vulgar or common gold. To the alchemists, the appearance of the Ouroboros was a great sign. Only the living presence of the eternal images can lend the human psyche a dignity which makes it morally possible for man to stand by his own soul and be convinced that it is worth his while to persevere with it. Yes. This is from the Mysterium Conjunctionis, volume 14, pages 363 and 364, and it's paragraph 511 from volume 14. Okay. Only the living presence of the eternal images can lend the human psyche a dignity which makes it morally possible for a man to stand by his own soul and be convinced that it is worth his while to do so. Only then will he realize that the conflict is in him and that the discord and tribulation are his riches, which should not be squandered by attacking others, and that if fate should exact a debt from him in the form of guilt, it is a debt to himself. Then he will recognize the worth of his psyche. For nobody can owe a debt to a mere nothing. But when he loses his own values, he becomes a hungry robber, the wolf, lion, and other ravening beasts, which for the alchemist symbolize the appetites that break loose when the black waters of chaos, that is the unconsciousness of projection, have swallowed up the king. A lot, isn't it? Yeah. That's a lot. Again, this is in the Mysterium. Okay? This is an image where up here there's a peacock, and there's a lion in the flask, and the woman in the circle. On the outer edge, where there's a syzygy of the sun and the moon, there's a peacock in a cloud of blue-green feathers. And then there's a lion underneath, and the woman is in the flask at the top. Okay? So this is the emblem of the peacock's flesh and the lion's blood, emblems of concupiscence and pride. Okay. Desirousness. It's hard not to want things. He's referring here now to an alchemical manuscript called the Cantilena. He's in the middle of a whole discourse on that. That's where these paragraphs come from. But this image happens to be from the Vessels of Hermes. It's part of the manuscript that I was working with for several years. It's a subtle feature of the Cantilena that the pregnancy cravings of the mother are stilled with peacock's flesh and lion's blood, that is, with her own flesh and blood. If the projected conflict is to be healed, it must return into the psyche of the individual, where it had its unconscious beginnings. That, if the projected conflict is to be healed, it must return to the psyche of the individual where it had its unconscious beginnings. He must celebrate a last supper with himself and eat his own flesh and drink his own blood, which means that he must recognize and accept the other in himself. But if he persists in his one-sidedness, the two lions will tear each other to pieces. Is this perhaps the meaning of Christ's teaching, that each must bear his own cross? For if you have to endure yourself, how will you be able to rend others also? Do you want to hear that one more time? I find it very hard to paraphrase Jung, you know. You kind of have to sit with the block of his text and take it in, and I find that I have to digest him many times. It's a subtle feature of the Cantilena that the pregnancy cravings of the mother are stilled with peacock's flesh and lion's blood, that is, with her own flesh and blood. And he's talking about her body, he's not talking about her children. Right? He's talking about gnawing on your finger. If the projected conflict is to be healed, It must return into the psyche of the individual where it had its unconscious beginnings. He must celebrate a last supper with himself. So you have to sacrifice something, right? This desirousness and pride. You have to sacrifice these things. Of course, that's the task of new parents, right? When the kid wakes up at 3 a.m. and he'd really rather sleep, right? Or it's the fourth time or whatever. But if he persists in his one-sidedness, the two lions will tear each other to pieces. Is this perhaps the meaning of Christ's teaching that each must bear his own cross? For if you have to endure yourself, how will you be able to rend others also? I'm going to read the footnote from this passage because something starts to happen when you take the conflict back into yourself and you begin to assimilate this other, which is your shadow. In the midst of the chaos, a small globe is happily indicated, and this is the supreme point of junction of all that is useful for this quest. This small place, more efficient than all the entirety, this part which comprises its whole, this accessory more abundant than its principle, on opening the store of its treasures, causes the two substances to appear which are but a single one. Of these two is composed the unique perfect, the simple abundant, the composite without parts, the only indivisible hatchet of the sages, from which emerges the scroll of destiny, extending evenly beyond the chaos, after which it advances in ordered fashion to its rightful end. In these words, Beryl Alde de Verville describes the germ of unity in the unconscious. And that's the footnote from that paragraph, 511. That was 512. So here we have turning oneself into a circulatory process, and the one who proceeds from the clash of opposites. Such reflections are justified by the alchemical symbolism. This is still Jung. This is the subsequent paragraph. As one can easily see, if one examines the so-called allegories a little more closely and does not dismiss them at the start as worthless rubbish, the miraculous feeding with one's own substance, so strangely reflecting its prototype, Christ, means nothing less than the integration of those parts of the personality which are still outside ego consciousness. Okay? The miraculous feeding with one's own substance means nothing less than the integration of those parts of the personality which are still outside ego consciousness. Lion and peacock, emblems of concupiscence and pride, signify the overweening pretensions of the human shadow which we so gladly project on our fellow man in order to visit our own sins upon him with apparent justification. And the age-old image of the Ouroboros lies the thought of devouring oneself and turning oneself into a circulatory process. For it was clear to the more astute alchemists that the prima materia of the art was man himself. The Ouroboros is a dramatic symbol for the integration and assimilation of the opposite, i.e. of the shadow. This feedback process is at the same time a symbol of immortality, since it is said of the Ouroboros that he slays himself and brings himself to life, fertilizes himself and gives birth to himself. He symbolizes the one who proceeds from the clash of opposites, and he therefore constitutes the secret of the prima materia, which as a projection unquestionably stems from man's unconscious. Okay? I'll say that again, this part. This feedback process is at the same time a symbol of immortality, since it is said of the Ouroboros that he slays himself and brings himself to life, fertilizes himself, and gives birth to himself. He symbolizes the one who proceeds from the clash of opposites, and he therefore constitutes the secret of the prima materia, which as a projection, so that's putting it in the flask, unquestionably stems from man's unconscious. Accordingly, there must be some psychic datum in it which gives rise to such assertions. And these assertions must somehow characterize that datum, even if they are not to be taken literally. And that's a mouthful. We'll come back to that. What the ultimate reason is for these assertions or manifestations must remain a mystery, but a mystery whose inner kinship with the mystery of faith was sensed by the adepts, so that for them the two were identical. Okay. This is Jung. That's paragraph 513, pages 364 and 65 in volume 14. When Jung speaks of the psychic datum, he is declaring the factual nature of psychological truth that cannot be expressed any other way. To the alchemist, the Ouroboros and Christ are equivalent. Assimilating one's own shadow is a spiritual act that brings the Godhead into existence. Yes?
Question is your use of pronouns, actually, because I get confused. I mean, Jung is saying terms and, you know, using words like he all the time, and then when you read that, it just kind of seems conflictual. Because the Ouroboros isn't a he, so to speak. I just feel like, as a woman, I would prefer to hear more about our position in the whole alchemical field.
You know, since he's really talking about matter, it would be nice if he used the feminine. I don't know if it reads any easier in the German. Where's Barbara? You know, there's a certain amount of getting through Jung writing in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s that you just, it's just tough.
Yeah, and the whole idea of projection,
yes,
implies that it is the man who projects,
and
it is the person being projected upon, which is often the feminine.
Well, and one of the difficulties is that the European languages are gender-inflected languages, so when you translate it, the he is there for whatever the noun is that's going on, and it was, and I'm not apologizing, it was the convention up until we all fought for it, you know, and it was in all of our textbooks and all of the liturgy that everything was he, and so I don't disagree with you, but if I were to start saying he, she through every paragraph and every sentence in Jung, we'd all be a little bit something. So ask the question again a little bit. How is it for me reading Jung?
Projection first, and integrating the shadow or whatever. To always assume that we are the projector on other people and need to withdraw it when in fact we may be the projector upon.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't disagree with that. I guess I spend a lot of time in therapy with, you know, the first part of the work is sort of sorting out whose trash is in your yard. You know, is this your stuff? Is this projections that you've had to work with, you know, because you were somebody's negative anima figure or, you know, whatever. You know, there's a lot of hours that goes into just doing that sort, and that's part of the process. So when I'm sitting face to face with somebody, I'm not quoting it in the he form. And I would say 80% of my practice are women, is women. You know, I've got about, it's really lopsided. It's often the women coming in because they've been put upon with projections and all kinds of things. So I don't disagree with you at all about that. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I heard you say something like, if you started to allow this, or took the initiative to change form, we'd all be in a different
sense. I didn't, because there was a whole passage in my dissertation where I changed all of the words he to he and she, or I tried to make it or something like that. I did it for pages. in my typing. And there's just a certain amount, if I'm going to read straight from the transcripts of Jung out of the collected works, that's the convention that Jung used. So I'm going with that rather than going back and trying to edit even more, you know. Because to me, the critical ideas here are that I have no problem thinking that I project stuff onto other people either. So I can put myself in that position and think about what those projections mean and what it means to contain them. Because I have to contain my projections too, right? So my unfinished thought was just that it gets to be really a significant editing process to go through and change all of the original language when I'm reading straight out of the collected works.
So I'm going to play with that a little bit.
Go ahead.
At least what I find, and in terms of some people are using projective recruitment as opposed to projective identification, if I allow that to circulate in me, I find myself enriched by it. And so you have to make a choice. If there's one person uncomfortable, we would not do it. Or do some of the folks who find that they're enriched, do we allow once in a while that kind of movement?
You mean to reverse all the pronouns?
No, to free to do it some of the time and do it.
Yeah.
I realize that I now feel free to do that in things that I do as a result of this conversation.
Right. And I know that I did that in my dissertation. I spent a lot of time typing and transcribing and trying to put things into a slightly other context, because part of the difficulty with all of this projection onto matter and evil and sin is that the feminine, as we are opening myth, creation myth of Marduk slaying Tiamat, right, is that this is a really devastating experience. And when women are the carriers of evil and, you know, the temptress and all of those things, it's really, really difficult. It's really difficult. So, yeah, I mean, I appreciate the comment, but it's one of those things that I don't know what I've done with it over so many years of doing it, but I think I straddled the whole era of masculine pronoun, the integration of the feminine, changing the language, because I can remember my textbooks in the 70s and getting to where I got and where I am now. So I appreciate bringing up the point. So I have in my notes that this is a good time to pause anyway and take a stretch break and have a cup of coffee, because this is a lot to ingest and sit with when we take in Jung like that. So let's take a break. Before we go on, because there's a couple more parts to this, I just want to take time for any other questions. This is dense. This is Jung, and it's dense. So I just want to know, you know, are you digesting? Are you going to walk out of here with lead bellies, you know? Or are the images actually helping as you get to see them? Does it make more sense because you're looking at what's going on with the Ouroboros and with the images in the flasks and stuff? Is that helpful? Okay. Because if I were just standing up here without all these beautiful pictures talking about the snake with its tail in its mouth, you could be a little bit wandry, I think. So does anybody have questions? I mean, this stuff with Jung about if you assimilate your shadow, you are engaged in an active spiritual process that will bring about immortality. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Well, I'm not a therapist at all. I'm truly a novice. But I'm trying to figure out where this fits in the lifespan of an individual. I mean, will it happen normally? Will life events trigger this to happen? Will we all just begin to transform?
Well, I think life events cause us sometimes to go through a radical shift in our experience of ourselves and our relationship to the world.
And I know lots of people who go through lots of events and don't transform.
And don't do it, right.
So I'm wondering,
yeah, I mean, people can go on and just remain unconscious,
But if you have any sort of... Jung sometimes refers to it as an unfortunate fortune, that one has this need to become conscious. You know, you get into some kind of a conflict you can't resolve, and so you have to go deal with it. You get up against something, and you just can't escape it. And I guess the reason I brought up the whole thing about parents and children and divorce is that we end up literalizing these splits when actually it's really necessary for people to stop in their narcissistic self-interest and mature. Because part of what I haven't talked about is the way that uroboric reverie, you know, people can be stuck being the be-all, end-all. I don't have to change for anybody. And what happens if you don't hatch? Right? And a lot of marriages don't survive because one or the other, or maybe both, they never hatch. And then they've got a kid who's hatched, you know, and they're in this, you know, doing something with their primal parents and nothing's going on. So it's tough. And so I think that this imagery is really powerful to give us a lot of different levels on which to reflect. And I'm going to address some of those in the very last part of the talk. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes.
I was just curious when you said that parents haven't hatched. Could you maybe explain that a little more? They haven't become conscious, the way that they're aware of maybe some of their projections or some of their finished baggage?
I work with, occasionally I work with couples. I do a lot of work with individuals, and there was a couple of people that could come instantly to mind where the divorce happened because the familial history on one side of alcoholism and self-absorption, the daughter was the little anima projection of the father, and the mother was ignored. And, you know, and when the divorce happened, the kid, the teenager, won the Oedipal War. She got dad instead of mom. And the hostilities that go on and on and on. And I hear this stuff. It's just terrible. You know, lawyers make a lot of money off divorces like this. And so when one person becomes conscious and the other one doesn't, you know, it can be pretty nasty. And so I would just see these kinds of interactions in my practice. You know, and often the person who comes in has got, you know, behind them narcissistic parents on one side or the other and all these things. And so there's a lot of things that the kid has been carrying who's now 45 or 60 and the family's never dealt with, because there's been all of this unconscious. But one person sometimes is called to become conscious. And so as I was saying, sometimes you have to sort of, you know, see whose trash is in your yard and get rid of all of that before you get to, well, what's your issue? You know, where are you stuck? And what's your conflict about yourself, about what you want to do or can't do, or how do you resolve that? And so this opposites, understanding this becomes really important, you know. So, yeah. Yes. Yes. Yes, that was my question, yeah. Well, I think what Jung is talking about is an iota of increase in consciousness in the world per se. Is that, you know, if you read elsewhere in the collected works, Jung talks about this idea that God needs mankind in order to become conscious of God's self. And there's the masculine again, but it's like, you know, what is this factor of consciousness? What is the one? What is if the Godhead is all of the opposites combined, it is male and female. You know, it is the feminine as well as the masculine. It is good and evil. It is light and darkness. So what is it? And when you wrest a little bit of that consciousness from the unconscious, what changes in the world? And I think that's what he's talking about. And because the adepts often in their, the alchemists had this picture of the dove descending into the work, they really saw it as a spiritual practice. Last night I was eating my dinner and channel surfing, and I ended up catching a part of a PBS show where this historian had gone looking at the colleagues around Michelangelo and looking at some of his sculptures and dug around and found papers in the archives of the Vatican from the Inquisition where Michelangelo and several of his contemporaries were leaning more towards the Protestant Reformation of Martin Luther and free thinking, and thinking that in order to be spiritual, one did not need the intermediary of the Pope, that one could seek the true light on one's own. And so in this, the mausoleum, it's for one of the popes, and there's the Moses figure with the horn coming up. Instead of looking straight out at the priest who's conducting the service, the figure is looking towards the light over this way, and they can see that Michelangelo recarved the head so that it was not going to look at the authority of the church for divine enlightenment, but was going to look to the spirit itself. And so there were all of this stuff about, and the guy who became pope was involved with the Inquisition and all these things. And so there's this idea that's in around the same time as these alchemical manuscripts of being able to know God directly without being told by a paternalistic clergy how to do it, you know? Yeah. Right. This is a whole period when all of this is going on. And so to look at the spirit in matter was a very heretical thing to do, to be able to have this understanding. Okay. So, thank you. Sure. I think that the Ouroboros is one of those archetypal symbols that erupts independent of time. It's one of those eternal things that bursts forth. But there's a way, and I'm sure Jung says this someplace, because he talks about the great serpent, that the zodiac is laid out on the back of a snake. You know, and so when we cycle through all the houses and all of the constellations and the that we go through a whole Ouroboric circle. Right, and it goes counterclockwise, actually, right? And so we're going to get to that in a quick minute. But I don't, you know, spiral, circle, I think the images come as they come, as opposed to, I mean, we've looked at a lot of them going by here, and no two are identical, really, right? In terms of what the serpents look like, and so, you know, I think it's an open question, and I wouldn't presume to know. It's out of my pay grade. That's the, yeah, right, the numinous effect. Because I think the spiral would be another archetype that we could explore. Just like you could explore the labyrinth or fire, right? The spiral would be its own. You can do that presentation. We can find lots of images. So, yeah. Next up is the fourfold structure. The number four is an archetypal symbol of wholeness. And I'm going to refer you to page 487 in the General Index to the Collected Works, which is volume 20. Jung's references to the number four get a page and a third of the next column. Okay, so I'm not going to presume to try to distill that many references about why he says the number four has to do with the number with wholeness, but he's done the homework. Okay, so you're going to have to trust me a little bit. So. This is the axiom of Maria. One becomes two, two becomes three, and out of the third comes the one as the fourth. When writing my dissertation on the vessels of Hermes, I used a fourfold structure to look at the location of the symbols in each illustration. The fourfold division begins with a bisecting a square into an upper half representing spirit and a lower half representing matter. The square is then divided vertically with the left side representing the unconscious and the right side consciousness, resulting in the four quadrants. A is the quadrant of conscious spirit, B is unconscious spirit, C unconscious matter, and D conscious matter. I place this template over each illustration to see what symbols were contained therein. Does anybody else want to say anything about the number four? You all acquainted with four as the number of wholeness in Jung. How many of you know? You know that pretty well? Somebody had a question, comment?
Is that the horse of ass?
Is that what?
The horse's ass on the
Yeah. Yeah, the quadrant of unconscious matter is, in fact, the rump of the horse. And again, you know, these are different drawings, and you could, and I did this quadrant I put on every one of them that I was looking at. I put these over it just to see what was there, and then looked at how that affected things. And the Latin translates that's written on the horse says, this is certainly the philosopher's fire of putrefaction. So the dead horse, the rotting flesh, they had lots of elaborate descriptions of what temperature to keep the heat at for the work. And so, you know, rotting horse or a compost pile or, you know, wet wood, you know, they didn't have electricity, they didn't have gas. And so trying to cook this stuff required a lot of diligence, and so they would use these different images. And again, these are images that they saw inside of a flask, so this is what's going on. But what I did do when I was writing my dissertation was I looked at what did it mean with the head of the serpent in the quadrant of conscious spirit assimilating his tail, and what was going on through the unconscious spirit, what was happening with that, what was going on with unconscious matter of the Ouroboros, and then as it transformed and was coming up, one of the premises is that when you have this aha in the body, when you have a physical shift in consciousness, it changes what your conscious attitude is, and it comes up counterclockwise, it comes up from below. Okay, you mix these things, the conscious and the unconscious, and stir them up, and then you get this other kind of knowing that comes from your own experience. Rather than somebody putting ideas into your head, you mix those ideas with other experiences, and it cooks. So. Okay. Yes? Right.
That Jung was able to use all of this material in his documents.
In his analysis, yeah. Just The Mysterium is an amazing book. You know, the Psychology of the Transference based on the Rosarium, another amazing book. And now the Red Book is out, and that's his raw material. And he thought if that book came out during his lifetime, people would think he was completely crazy. And when he found alchemy, he said, ah, I have a historical precedent that I can look at that has the similar images that I was getting through my own dreams, active imagination, visions, that would come to him at night, you know, or whenever, and he had something else to look at and said, okay, this is not unique in the history of the world. And people have been working on this for a long time, and this is about the creation of consciousness. and wresting it out of the chaos of the unconscious. Yeah. Okay. Let's go on. Okay, so we look at the astrological signs and the houses. And so another part of the analysis that I did was to take this the signs of the zodiac in this particular model and put it over the top of the pictures and look at what was going on. That way. Yes, it's flipped and it's backwards. And the reason for that is in astrology, the north is at the bottom, right?
The ascendant is on the
top. I put it on the upper right. And my reason for doing that was because the star chart based on the heavens is located towards the north star. On our paper and pencil maps, we have north at the top of the page. So I tried to orient it with north to the top. Okay? Because I don't know that anybody's ever actually done this before, I was given a certain amount of latitude to make it up. But yes, I was questioned on that before my dissertation defense, well before. And I was given dispensation. And so... what you get this way is in the quadrant of conscious spirit, in quadrant A, you have the developmental houses of childhood, right? The birth and mom and dad, you get through the first ones about the ego development and those signs, and then when you go to the next, you get towards unconscious spirit, and it seems to work for me to have looked at it that way, right? So... I mean, and it is, you know, it's arbitrary the way I did it. I did have a consultant when I was trying to put this together, and that was Russ Lockhart. So if it helps for you to know that I did have an analyst on my team, that was one. Okay. The other little synchronicity, and my dissertation chair was Lionel Corbett, and in February, I was halfway through my manuscript, and my mom passed away in January of 2004. And I went back in February to be with my dad. And I had been given a name, I guess from Russ, of Alice Howell. Okay? And she lives in Massachusetts, just over the state line from where my dad and my sister live. So I was back there for 10 days, and I took my half-finished manuscript over to Alice Howell and said, I wanted to do it this way. Was that okay? Because Lionel had asked me, you know, something. And she said, I was teaching astrology in Chicago when Lionel came in. I did his chart. The rest is history. So I think I'm okay. But that's, you know, I don't claim by any stretch of the imagination to be an astrologer. Not remotely. So what I did in my interpretation was pretty well self-taught. But... nobody argued me out of it when they read through it. So, okay. So we can go on back to the astrology. So there we have the chart. So you have the nuclear family experience. You have sort of the social aspects. You have education and career, and then you have self and world, right? As we move through. And so as we're heading, this self and world quadrant is going to make a lot of impact here shortly. Okay. So astrology was part of the worldview of the alchemists. The signs of the horoscope were consulted for propitious days to undertake the work. The planets, equivalents to the metals, were frequently referenced throughout alchemical manuscripts. So they talk about Jupiter and Saturn and stars of Mars and star flowers of Venus, and they go on about all this stuff, and it was silver and antimony and sulfur. And so they just mix it up a lot. And Jung came to think, he did, I think, 10 years of equivalence, of just writing down equivalents of what were in these alchemical manuscripts, and he decided that earth was equivalent to air, was equivalent to fire, was equivalent to water. That they just used them for whatever. Okay? So, So the planets, equivalents to the metals, were frequent reference throughout the alchemical manuscripts. The conjunctio of the sun and the moon, known as the hieros gamos or the syzygy, defines the union of opposites. The integration of masculine and feminine consciousness results in their transformation and an expansion of consciousness. So this syzygy of the sun and the moon is what he goes through in the Rosarium, with the king and the queen standing on the sun and the moon, and then they're sitting in the hot tub, right? And then they make love, and then they die. Okay, so that whole thing. But when they are resurrected, there's a transformation of consciousness. Okay, so. So I overlaid the horoscope on the illustrations to see what symbol was being affected by what planet in which house to deepen my understanding of the images. In this image, the third house contains the mouth and the tail, the beginning and the end of the Ouroboros, the birds, the curtains, and part of the crown. The words liberal admiratione, so this is abundant wonder, and re aphenia, which is like coming together with like. The Ouroboros and the birds symbolize Mercury. Their presence in this house of interactions, which is governed by Mercury, suggests that the mind is intensely active and curious. There is a great need to know. The intersection of self and world. I want to explore the problem of the opposites, this assimilation of the shadow, and the process of what the process of regeneration might look like in a socio-political or a cultural context. Here are a few examples. On the eve of the wedding of a local rabbi's daughter, the former president of his congregation was shot and killed at the Jewish Federation in a brutal, insane, and hate-filled attack, and others were injured. Our country is trying to come to grips with the enormous disparity of wealth between 1% and 99% of the population. Europe is looking at austerity versus investment in the future. So we are in time. We are giving consideration to the opposites and what we synthesize out of them, what we take back of our own shadow. It's not trivial. Doctor, activist, political activist, humanitarian. Some of you may have heard of James Orbinski, the Canadian physician, past president of Doctors Without Borders, on whose behalf he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in 1999. In an interview about his book, An Imperfect Offering, Humanitarian Action in the 21st Century, he described significant life-changing moments in which the contrast between the opposites changed his consciousness. In the first instance, he was a volunteer physician working in Africa, treating the victims of famine. He paused for a child in a life-threatening state of starvation, who was thrashing as he tried to insert an NG tube. Raising his head, he looked into the dense, variegated green of the lush landscape outside the window. He allowed himself to enter deeply into the question, why, in such a fertile place, am I treating a child for starvation? His inquiry led him to discover that the policies of the International Monetary Fund had led to the planting of cash crops for export, such as coffee, at the expense of farming and food production for the local population. He decided to leave his medical practice in Canada to work full-time for Doctors Without Borders. There's the impact of the opposites. And it kind of answers your question, do you have to be in therapy to do this? No. The world will bring it to you. After the assimilation of the opposites, a new consciousness arises. On a return trip to Africa, treating the survivors of the butchery in the midst of the Rwandan genocide, another transformative experience occurred. As a surgeon, trained to make incisions to save lives, he found himself trying to understand the perspective of the perpetrator of the ghastly wounds on the woman in front of him. And on the radio, he talked about what those wounds were. It was horrifying. He realized with revulsion that the attacker had clearly taken pleasure in the deliberate mutilating of another human being. The woman, fully present to his, James Orbinski's, nausea and suffering, knew well why he was sickened. She, in the midst of her injuries and pain, comforted him, encouraging him with the words, in her language. Courage, my friend. Courage, my friend. To strengthen him so that he could treat her wounds. When he had sutured the most life-threatening ones, she gently sent him on to treat the equally ghastly wounds of the numerous others at the medical station. Edinger states, just having the experiences of being attracted to things and repulsed by things does not constitute consciousness. Consciousness requires a simultaneous experience of opposites and the acceptance of that experience. And the greater the degree of this acceptance, the greater the consciousness. The Mystery of the Conjunctio. The little book, Alchemical Images of Individuation. Little book of his lectures. So, the moment when James Orbinski swallowed the most nightmarish image imaginable was a uroboric moment. The archetype was constellated with physical force. He was met with complete presence by this suffering woman with understanding and compassion. The field of consciousness that surrounded the two of them remains. So that's where we'll close. Yes, questions, comments.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.